The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, things happen when people start talking. You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU School of Business. Programs are also made possible in part by a grant from the Idaho Humanities Council, a state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Forum series sponsors are AARP Idaho, Echelon Group, Micron, and St. Luke's Health System. The moderator for today's forum is Gloom My Beat, with guest Kendra Pierre Lewis of the New York Times, is Todd Dvorak.
And thank you for being here today for this City Club of Boise Forum on what in the world is it like to be a New York Times reporter covering global warming and climate change. We've entitled this forum, Is Gloom My Beat? And we're hoping our guest can prove us wrong and make a case that there are reasons to be upbeat, to believe that there's more to this complex issue than just one depressing development after another. My name is Todd Dvorak, and I am a member of the City Club's Forum Committee and your moderator today. Before we get started, I want to welcome our radio audience, an audience tuned into Boise State Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 and its affiliates throughout southern Idaho and northern Nevada. Along with that, I want to thank our media partners who help make these events possible. This includes Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, and Peppershock Media. I also want to thank our forum sponsors whose help is critical for these types of forums and events. Today, this includes Micron Technology, AARP Idaho, the Echelon Group, and St. Luke's Health System. Now, before I welcome and introduce our guest, I want everybody to know that the conversations for these forums are really driven in part by your participation. So with that in mind, we encourage you to use those cards that are on your table and fill out the questions, the pressing issues that you would like me to ask our guest today. Seeing as how this is my first time ever moderating one of these things, there's a good chance that I'm going to misrepresent your question or ignore it altogether. Volunteers will come by the table to pick up your cards, just wave it in the air, and they will do their best to get it to me. Okay, let's welcome our guest, Kendra Pierre Lewis, a staff reporter for the New York Times climate team. Kendra was born and raised in Queens, New York, and seeing as how her employer is based in New York City, she still lives there today. She joined the Times in December 2017, and before that was a staff reporter with Popular Science, where she covered the environmental issues of the day and science. Her work has been published in The Washington Post, 538, Modern Farmer, and Slate. In 2012, she published a book called Greenwash, Why We Can't Buy Our Way to a Greener Planet. She earned a bachelor's degree in economics from Cornell University and a master's in science writing from Massachusetts Institution of Technology. This is only her second visit to Idaho, so I encourage her, as I'm sure you all do, to come back another time and see all the beauty and fun that it has to offer. And I will just throw this out because she's made it very public, but the one fly in her life's ointment is mayonnaise. And I don't pretend to really understand that. Perhaps she should have been here last month for our food forum to talk about that or defend mayonnaise or whatever. But without further ado, let's welcome Kendra Pierre Lewis.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Great. Well, we're excited to have you.
And for the record, For the record, the problem with mayonnaise is everything.
Good to know. All right, so I'm going to get started by asking a selfish question. Seeing as how I'm a former journalist, I think it's really interesting for you to imagine being you and deciding on a daily or weekly basis, what am I going to write about? I mean, I would guess that your email box is chock full of the latest reports and scientific studies and pitches from all kinds of groups wanting you to come visit and write about this aspect of climate change or global warming or why the whole thing is a hoax. So I'd be curious to know how you go about deciding what to write about on a daily basis or weekly or even longer term.
Sure. So can you guys hear me? Is this better or worse?
Not much.
Okay. I don't know what to tell you. Yeah, so luckily the climate desk at the New York Times is actually pretty sizable. There are a bunch of us. And so within that, there is some specialization. So we have some reporters that very much focus on the politics elements of climate change. We have some reporters that are more internationally focused. We have one reporter that primarily focuses on investigations, and my beat is mostly the science underpinning things. And so that makes it easier in some ways, having that sort of breakdown, because there are some times when a topic will come up, and I will be like, oh, this is interesting, but not in my wheelhouse, and just send it off to a colleague. Obviously, these aren't, like, discrete. There's always some overlap between science and politics and all of those things. And so we try to work together. But that makes it easy just in terms of broad themes. For me specifically, sometimes there's, like, no choice. So if they're during the California wildfires, for example, that's clearly kind of a climate change story embedded in that. So, of course, we're going to do it. Other things, it's very much, so I did a story last year on the kelp forest in Northern California disappearing, and that began because I learned that kelp forests were a thing. I didn't know that they were, and I became immediately enamored with them as an ecosystem and the fact that they were disappearing because of warmer waters, and so it became about knowing the science and trying to find a way to tell that story.
Is it difficult to sift through all of those opportunities to tell this story? How much of it is on your own sort of exploration of these issues?
Yeah, it's a mixture. I spend a lot of time reading scientific journals. My editors make suggestions, obviously. Sometimes it's things where you start noticing that there's a trend. So, like, the first article comes out and it's not big enough or significant enough. By article, I mean, like, study, to report on its own, and then there's a second one, and there's a third one, and you start realizing that there's a trend in the literature, and that kind of that compilation makes it worthy of being reported on. And sometimes it's just whimsy or, capturing people's imagination, and so that makes it, we did a story, this is really gross, but we did a story, and it was literally essentially like this guy had, this researcher had found, like, I'm making up the number because I can't remember, but it's like 60,000 ticks on a single moose. And that was essentially the story. It was like really disgusting, but it really kind of triggered and made people realize the impact of climate change on the ability of ticks to sort of last longer, and they have been really negatively impacting moose populations in the Northeast and in Minnesota. And so on the one hand, you can tell, and we have told, this big sort of sweeping story about the impact of climate change on moose, but also this was a really small kind of tiny piece, like 500 words, but that really captured people, like really resonated with people, and they were able to kind of grasp really quickly that impact of like insects and climate change and that interaction.
Idaho is one of the reddest states in the nation, and Idaho voters supported President Trump, and we've elected Republican legislatures and Republican governors now for decades. It's a state that also has a streak of suspicion for government and certainly environmental regulation, and even to a certain extent a dose of skepticism about science and maybe a lessening of belief in science. When you are writing your stories and thinking about how to outline your story, are you thinking about people like that in terms of how do I speak to that audience? How do I speak to the group that is denying this? Or do you just sort of figure, I can't win that battle?
I sort of assume my goal as a reporter is not to persuade anyone, so I'm not trying to get them to come over to quote-unquote my side or the side of, you know, the fact that climate change is real. Before I worked for The Times, I worked for Popular Science, and a lot of their readers live in red states. And so that fundamentally really forced me to think about the way in which we communicate and how very often you will sort of use language that is shorthand and contextually in, very much based in culture. And I couldn't sort of assume that whoever is reading what I was reading necessarily accepted the science of climate change or held all of these sort of bigger, broader values with me. And one of the things that I think is really problematic with climate change in particular is we've sort of combined climate change and like the left in this country, which is a unique position. So like a lot of countries in Europe, for example, there is no denial movement and there is no like if you go on the left and you go to the right and you ask someone if climate change, if they accept the science, they will say, yes, I accept the science of climate change. Where they disagree in terms of like conservative versus liberal is how you deal with the problem. So are you talking more free market solutions or are you talking like more government intervention, right? And in the United States, we've sort of coupled together those values that if you're on the left and you believe in X, Y, and Z, you also believe in climate change. And if you're on the right and you believe in X, Y, and Z, you don't believe in climate change. And so what I try and keep in mind in my reporting is I'm not coupling all of these other values with this science, that I'm really making an effort to only focus on the science and on the climate change and decoupling it from other shared values. And so that means being really careful with language. That means being trying to be really precise. I don't know if I'm always there, but I really do try and not sort of assume that people, like, have all of these other values because they accept climate change. So one really good example, and this is before I joined the Times, I did this story. This was when Pruitt was becoming head of the EPA. And there were a lot of stories that came out that was like, Pruitt wants to get rid of environmental regulations. And now if you like environmental regulations, this is a bad thing. If you hate environmental regulations, this is a good thing. So what sounds like a neutral sounding title actually isn't. It's actually, depending on your perspective, it's actually very biased. And so I did a story that didn't actually discuss either of those things. I asked, why do we have an EPA? And I sort of did this like four-part series that took us through the history of the creation and sort of the polarization of the EPA because it wasn't always such a polarizing institution. I sort of took it outside of that context where some people would automatically think it was bad or some people would automatically think it was good to kind of like take a step back and say like, why did we create this institution in the first place?
Okay. This morning we had breakfast, mm-hmm. and we were talking about some of the stories that you're working on and some of the things, the broader questions of what happens in the next few years, few decades. And one of the things that I thought was interesting when you were talking about was even if we come up with agreed solutions to dial back greenhouse gas and the problems that it causes for the warming of the earth, or even if we figure out how to do that in the near future, what are still the consequences that we are looking at based on what has happened so far?
Right. So one of the analogies that climate scientists sort of like to use is that the climate system is like a freight train. So it takes a really long time to slow it down. And so we do have a certain amount of warming baked into the system. How many of us here were born after 1976? Okay, we have never, the reason I'm asking this is not ageism, but we have never experienced a normal temperature year. So we've, our entire...
What do you mean by that?
I mean, it's always been warmer than historical average or warmer than it should have been since before we were born, essentially. We've never known normal. And so that means that we can't get back, like if we can't get back to normal because we don't really know what that is and because there's this long lag. What we're trying to do essentially is there's a freight train and it's heading towards a cement wall. What we're trying to decide is how quickly are we going to hit that wall. If we hit it pretty slow, the damage will be minimal. If we hit it pretty fast, the damage will be pretty significant. What does that mean in practical terms? Well, my colleagues did a story that looked at the difference between 1.5 degrees C warming and 2 degrees C warming. I'm going to roll back a little bit to explain what that means. When we release greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, the more you release, the more heat gets trapped, right? So the hotter the Earth gets. If we release less greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, the Earth gets less hot. At 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, meaning warmer than average, then the coral reefs still exist. At 2 degrees C, most of them are gone. That's sort of the kind of level of cataclysmic change we're looking at.
Probably should have started with this question.
Uh-huh.
So whoever out there provided this one, that you can moderate next time. Please explain the difference between climate change and global warming. And from three perspectives, how you approach it journalistically, mm-hmm. how we approach it politically, and scientifically.
Okay.
Is there a new difference?
So politically, or journalistically, there's no difference between climate change and global warming. Scientifically, there is a difference because climate variation has always been a thing. We're entering into a warm cycle. Because of greenhouse gas emissions, the globe is warming. So the climate is both changing and warming. That is the warming is a kind of change that is happening. Does that make sense? And then politically, we're getting into the use of language and how language can be weaponized. And so that is sort of like where it gets teased apart. So there is a difference between climate change and global warming, but generally as a reporter, when I'm talking about climate change, I'm talking about global warming. There is no difference. Does that make any sense? Like, scientifically there is a difference, but most of us aren't scientists and you're not reading studies, and that difference in terms of what we're talking about with the planet doesn't make, it's a difference without distinction for those of us who are not climatologists.
This kind of gets back to a little bit of Idaho here. This year at the legislature, there was a hearing on climate change. The governor has an initiative.
Yeah.
And three of Idaho's iconic companies or institutions testified about how they view this challenge and the things that they think they need to be doing. There was Simplot and Micron that was there, I believe. Idaho National Lab was there. This week, Idaho Power announced that it had set a goal for itself to be on total clean energy by 2045, I think, I believe. Am I right, Rocky? Yeah. What does it say that companies like this in a state like this, and you know, apply this to other states and other companies too, mm-hmm. that they are getting out in front of this, whether it's to try to help change the debate? Is it really just self-interest that they're doing this for? What are you seeing this is the motivation? And
there's a really great climate scientist named Kate Marvel. She's out of NASA. And one of the things she likes to talk a lot about is that her family, her father in particular, did not accept the science of climate change. So she's a climatologist, and her dad didn't believe in climate change. And the way she convinced him was not by showing him charts, it was not by showing him the hard work that she was doing, but by pointing to the military and pointing to the insurance company and say they're incorporating climate change into their models. And these were institutions that he respected. Now, the military isn't looking at climate change because they're fuzzy and warm-hearted, although I'm sure some of them are. They're doing it because some of their installations are in peril. If you go to Annapolis in Maryland, my geography is terrible, they're dealing with serious flooding risk and serious future for their facilities. Like, it isn't in the insurance company, you know, are losing a tremendous amount of money from natural hazards, from hurricanes and wildfires and the flooding that's going on in the Midwest right now that are all exacerbated and by climate change. So these companies are being very pragmatic, and they're looking down the landscape and they're saying, hey, these these negative side effects of climate change are going to impact us. We need to do something to move the needle on it. And we've gotten to a point where it's undeniable, where even within sort of like the denialist movement, they're no longer arguing that the climate isn't changing. They're just questioning whether or not it's human caused or not. So we're all, the vast majority of us, accept that there's something weird going on with our climate system. So that's why they're doing it. It's completely pragmatism, and I'm not saying that in a negative sense. I'm saying that it's because they're realizing that it's going to hurt them down the line.
Is it, are you seeing, though, more companies take a public stand on this and identifying themselves as we're doing this for global warming or to be part of this discussion, or is it still?
There are some companies that are doing it out of that because they're trying to be responsible stewards. There are some that are doing it because of shareholder activism. Their shareholders are requiring them to do it because there's a lot of risk and exposure. If you're not putting climate change into your planning, you're really putting your company at risk. And then there are some companies that are realizing that they can monetize it. So it's kind of all over the map, but they are doing it.
Regardless of the motives of doing it, is it moving the needle in terms of public perception of climate change and global warming?
I mean, Yale Climate Communications does these surveys of Americans periodically, and the vast majority of Americans accept the science of climate change. I know it can sound like it can not feel that way, but, and by the vast majority, I mean more than 70, 75%. So if you accept the science, you're actually in the vast majority, not in the minority. Even in, there are only like two counties in the United States where less than 50% of people accept the science of climate change. So even here, you're in the majority, although it may not feel that way. Most people don't talk about climate change very often. They talk about it for a few minutes a month, maybe. And so, you know, like it just, it's like the denial side gets a disproportionate amount of attention to the acceptance side.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to put your teacher's hat on here for a second.
Okay.
And give us a grade or two. Which countries or which places, regions of the world get and understand climate change? In other words, that are taking the steps that they believe are appropriate to deal with this issue and to try to slow this train down?
I don't feel confident or comfortable giving any country a grade, but my coworker Samini did a lot of work in Costa Rica. I can talk about who's doing interesting things, and Costa Rica is doing a lot of interesting things. New Zealand is doing a lot of interesting things, not just around climate change, but also against like climate justice. So like there are industries that we feel like are necessary for us to decarbonize. Well, people work in those industries. What happens to those jobs? What happens to the people working those jobs, and how do you sort of help them adapt to this changing economic landscape? So New Zealand's doing some pretty cool things. Copenhagen has been doing a lot around waste to energy. So a lot of countries, the Netherlands in general has been doing a lot around, you know, because they're a low-lying country, about what managed retreat. So how do you get at, like the seas are going to rise, they're already rising, how do you get out of harm's way?
What areas of the country, of our country, or what areas of the globe do you look to as the places to watch for the next 10 years for the most significant impacts caused by this phenomenon?
So there are two ways of thinking about it. Climatologists say that in climate change in general, cold places are warming the most, cold things generally. So nights are warming faster than days, and the poles. So like obviously you're looking to the poles because of the ice sheets. And also in the case of the Arctic, people live there. So like there's a huge impact there. But also in terms of quality of life, the tropics, because they're already so hot that they can't actually withstand that much more heat from like a biological perspective. And then you're dealing with more with tropical storms and increased severity of those. And the socioeconomic piece, right? Like, so it's not just how bad are things going to get from a weather or from perspective. It's also what's your ability to adapt and manage that. So when you're looking at some place like that just got hit by the cyclone, like Mozambique, this is a country that was devastated by a civil war. It's a country where the median age is 18, roughly. What capacity do they actually have to adapt to such a terrible event, right? Like they have fewer resources in other locations. So things like that are playing into factors. In the United States, the Southeast is a huge place that I'm really focused on.
Because
it's a hot place that's getting hotter, it's very humid, and there's a lot of like socioeconomic factors that are really important.
I'm going to take a quick break and just welcome our radio audience out there on KBSX 91.5. This is the City Club of Boise Forum with Kendra Pierre-Lewis from the New York Times, and she covers global warming and climate change. Okay, so here's, I've got two questions along the same lines. What can the individual, what can the family do on a daily basis or a weekly basis to do their part to address this issue?
We get that question a lot. We have a newsletter, a section on our newsletter called One Thing You Can Do. And so before I go into like what you can do, I want to preface this by saying that on an individual level, there's actually a limit to how much change you can affect. And so if doing these things takes away from other forms of pushing for change, it's probably a better use of your time to do those other things than to obsess over like what brand of eggs you buy or whether or not you eat eggs. Does that make any sense? All right. So there are kind of like obvious low-hanging fruit, like plastic use is a lot of attention right now because of what it's doing to the oceans. But we don't talk enough about the fact that plastic comes from oil, so it's actually a huge contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, and that use is expected to go up over the next 20 to 30 years. So finding ways of reducing the volume of single-use plastic in your life is a great place to start. Sorry, I'm trying to think of other tips. Oh, food waste is another really big one. Just eat the food you buy. We throw out a third of the food we take home in this country. So don't do that. And the whole life cycle of what it takes to make food is just tremendous. And so oftentimes people get very focused on like what is the best climate food for them to eat. But I kind of feel like if we just started with actually reducing the waste of food, that would have a tremendous effect and you wouldn't actually have to change a whole lot about what you eat or how you eat. But more broadly speaking, we get very focused on trying to affect policy change on the federal level, but there's a lot happening on state levels. So like California, for example, has drastically reduced its greenhouse gas emissions, and that's completely through state actions. So really pushing hard for your local government officials, both on the state, but also on the regional and like the city, the municipality level is huge. Putting people into power who if climate change is an issue that you take seriously, putting people into power who also take climate change seriously is really important. The people who end up begin in local elections are the people who end up in state and federal, right? So we kind of get into this circle where we only focus on like presidential elections and we forget about the people who we elect on the ground level. And so that's another place where it's really important. And then one thing that I'm kind of obsessed with, and I'm not sure how much it applies to Idaho, but planning board meetings are where a ton of decisions get made, land use decisions, and nobody goes to them but developers. It's really important as private citizens for you to go to them too and have that counterbalance.
What types of things would somebody want to consider if going to a planning board meeting? I mean, what is the matrix for decisions?
I live on the coast, and I'm kind of obsessed with the amount of development that we're continuing allowed to develop on the coast. There are cities where if flooding is an issue in your community, talking about how much of your green space you should get rid of is actually a huge consideration, because if you're developing on all of the green space, you're putting in a lot of permeable surfaces, and that allows for increased flooding. This is a hurricane example, but it's on the top of my head. Something like 30% of the flooding during Harvey is attributable just to impermeable surfaces. They paved over so much land that the water had nowhere to go. So those are the kinds of things that like are important, but that often sort of don't get focused on.
This is kind of more of a macro look at that same question. Are we at a point where we can slow the train down with the current technology and the ideas that we have available now, or is there technology that has to be developed yet?
We can slow the train down. I mean, every pretty much every scientist and every like broad speaking policymaker agrees is that we actually have the technologies to slow the train down. We don't have, not just in the United States, but globally, we don't have the political will. And part of that is we also don't really have the social will, right? Like I said earlier, people don't really think about climate change that much.
Do you or your colleagues think that global warming and climate change is going to be an issue in the 2020 election cycle? Or is there just too much else out there?
So I don't do political reporting. I can say that it's already started to come up. I'm going to screw up her name, but the Cole Jabbar from Minnesota, she mentioned it in when she declared that she was running. She mentioned it during her declaration. Mayor Pete, that everyone seems to love, he's, I think, exclusively running on a climate change platform. Is it not Mayor Pete? Thank you. It's Jay Inslee. I mean, I feel like it's already an issue. Whether or not it'll continue to be an issue, I don't have a fortune, and I don't have a crystal ball. I feel like it's already been raised.
What is the relationship between climate change and our Earth's growing population?
I hate that question. Clearly, there is fundamentally like a limit to how many people the planet can hold. That's like a statement of fact. The relationship between climate change and population is complicated because the places that are the most populous also consume the fewest resources. So it's not a one-to-one correlation. And we know that as people become more quote-unquote developed, their populations tend to decline naturally. But their consumption goes up. So I don't know if anyone's really done the math to figure out what that sweet spot is and what the level of consumption and number of people can be.
What is the level of understanding of climate change and the factors that are causing it in the American public right now? Have you seen any kind of surveys and polls on that? I guess I'm curious how much we understand what's really happening.
So Yale did a study, like the same Yale communications people, and they do a lot of these breakouts. And basically, the level of literacy, I would say, is not especially high, even among people who accept that it's happening. So they sort of accept that it's happening because they have broad strokes idea, but I'm not sure how well the mechanisms are understood.
So having a general sense that this is happening because I've read it somewhere, seen a television report on it,
right.
But the actual details of what's driving it, not so much.
Yeah, but I also think that that's like fair because, you know, I ride in an airplane and I have a vague idea of like lift, but like, I don't know, you know, like I don't really know how it works.
Fair enough. In countries that the science is more accepted and they're a little more proactive, how do you know how they have managed to depoliticize this issue to get a broader swath of the general public behind it?
You're actually kind of asking the wrong question.
Okay.
The right question is, why is it political? And so I went down this rabbit hole a while ago, and I started talking to all of these researchers. And basically, climate denialism from a political perspective is only really active in four countries. It's the United States, it's Canada, it's Australia, and the United Kingdom. All four countries speak English, which is important. I was like, oh, is it English that's the problem? And they were like, no. It's not. It's because English makes it easier to share it. The fact that we have a shared language makes it easier to transmit those ideas. Three out of the four countries have a large private fossil fuel sector. Naomi Oreskes out of Harvard wrote a really great book, and it was turned into a movie called Merchants of Doubt that talks a lot about how the climate change denialism movement sort of borrowed from the tobacco script of how to deliberately sow misinformation around the fact that climate change was real. We know because both the AP And Inside Climate News, where I did an internship, reported the fact that Exxon knew that climate change was happening since the 1970s and that they knew that they were causing it. Their own internal documents show this. And so really the question of like how it became so political is one that's uniquely, I don't want to say American, but like, I don't know, Anglo? I don't know how to phrase it. But yeah, we all have a private, and we all have this idea of the frontier. So this idea that you can go somewhere else when things get too bad. The problem is we can't outrun climate change because living on Mars would be worse.
What do you like about your job?
I'm a nerd, so I really enjoy like the science, and I like when I have a question that I can call up a scientist and ask them, and they will talk to me. That's great. I like connecting with people. It's a really good mix of like sitting at a desk and being really nerdy and reading things and like learning a lot and going out into the world and talking to people and talking about their experiences and just seeing the world. I love writing, so like being able to communicate with people. I like learning new things, all of it. Yeah, I mean, I do have a certain amount of like guilt associated with the travel that's associated with my job because it's kind of a catch-22, which is flying has a tremendous carbon footprint, and I think about that a lot. But I also don't drive, so I feel like at least that's a little bit better. That balances out some of the greenhouse gas emissions that I put out. But it's something I think about a lot. So there is that other side of it, which is I probably know more than most what we're doing to the planet, and that with that comes a tremendous side of guilt.
How much do you travel, or have the opportunity to go to different places to report on what's happening there and what you're seeing there?
Yeah, it's a mix. So I think from like September to March, I want to say, until like 2 weeks ago, I went nowhere. I took one trip to Washington, D.C., and now I'm traveling a bunch for the next month and a half. And so it's not quite a choice because there are some stories where you really have to go, but it's a mixture. It's balanced. So I'm not always on a plane, and I'm not always on the road, which is great for me because I have really bad travel karma. If there's a plane that's going to be delayed, I'm definitely on it. But so it's a mix. I'm not always, I mean, people think that I travel, I think, more than we do.
One more question, kind of sticking with your job and how you do it. What has been, with the Times, or even with Popular Science, what has been the most interesting story that you've told?
I don't know if this is the most interesting story, but I did a story on the Keystone XL pipeline, and I was talking to a farmer in Nebraska. So this was desk reporting. I didn't go out to Nebraska, and it was this guy, Jim. And this is one of the things that's really, as you can tell, I talk really fast. This is me slowing it down. I got on the phone with him, and like it took 10 seconds, and I was like, I'm going to get nowhere with this guy. So I started talking real slow because he was talking real slow. But he was great. When the pipeline was first coming through, it wasn't supposed to come through his land, and he was real upset about it because he wanted the money. And then they rerouted it, and it was supposed to come through his land. A guy came and knocked on his door and was like, "You won the lottery," and he was like, "Awesome." And then he read the contract, and he thought it was bad terms. Bold Nebraska started coming out and started holding town halls across Nebraska where the pipeline was going through, telling them what it was actually carrying and all of these things. He was conservative. He was very conservative. And I asked him, at the time, Obama was still in office. So I asked him, I was like, "How do you feel about like what's going on in Washington?" And he was like, "You know, I'm a Republican, but I'm really happy Obama's in office right now. Because of Obama's stance, had a better chance." At the time, the pipeline had not yet been, was in limbo. And then he told me, he was like, that he stood in solidarity with the Ponca people, which is their indigenous people of Nebraska. And it was just kind of interesting how this really lovely, very rural, very conservative Christian farmer had sort of, over a period of 7 years, his values hadn't changed at all. Like, he was still all of these things, but how he applied them had shifted and his perspective had shifted. And it was just really interesting hearing that transition within a person and not having any... He wasn't like, I was dumb before and I'm wise now. It wasn't like that, you know, without any self-recrimination. It was very much like we learn and we grow as we get older. And when we know better, we do better. And I don't know, it was just kind of one of my favorite interactions.
This is a question from the audience, so thank you. I'm going to paraphrase it a bit, but essentially it gets to this point. As humans, we have overcome a lot of stuff. Plague, wars, you name it. And we've always come out, perhaps, in a position where we know more, stronger, and certainly proving once again we can adapt. What do you tell people who may argue that even though climate change and global warming has these consequences, what do you tell that person who will say, hey, we've been here before? We'll come out of it, we'll figure it out, and we'll move on. That's what we do.
I mean, I feel like there are two ways of addressing that. One is kind of jokingly to say, you know, that's what the dinosaurs thought.
Look what they know.
But the other, which I think I take very seriously, and is that I honestly think that unless we do... you know, unless we continue to drastically increase the level of emissions that we release into the atmosphere, that portions of the Earth will remain habitable. But in the meantime, millions, if not billions, of people are probably going to die in horrific ways. And I don't want that on my conscience. And if the person I'm talking to is willing to have that on their conscience, then fair. There's an added element, which is the people who are poised to suffer the most from climate change are the people who did the least to contribute to the problem. So there is another, a parity or a fairness question that's in there. So I guess ultimately it comes down to asking what is a person's morality and how do they see that themselves passing through the world? And then there's kind of a practical question. So I have a little sister who's going to kill me if she ever hears this. And we often joke about the apocalypse because that's what we do. And and she very sincerely says, like, I don't want to survive that. like, when the end comes, you know, just like, I don't want to be there the day after tomorrow. I want to be out in the first wave. And we don't, I don't think we talk enough. Yes, we've survived wars and we've survived all these horrific things, but millions of people didn't. A lot of people died in them. Like, humanity survived, but what does that really mean, right? Like, a lot of people died in terrible, terrible ways. What? Sorry, that was grim.
It is called doom and gloom, right? Reporting on doom and gloom. Okay, so we all read... about these ways that the warming of the climate is affecting our lives. We are seeing glaciers melt. Reporters tell us that the wildfires that are blasting through the West in the summertime and the Southeast any day now are hotter and burning faster than recorded history. I'm curious, though, how... we bring that down into our daily lives. How are people noticing the impact of this change in the way that they operate from day to day?
You see it with, like, anyone garden? You see it with changing in, like, growing zones. Suddenly people are able to grow things they never could grow before, or things that they grew before, like, aren't doing as well. People see it when they go into, like, the forest and the trees look different. And the forest looks different because either they were burned out or just because things are shifting. This is really basic, but I grew up in New York, and I live there now, and I complain all the time, which is ironic because I hate the cold, that winter isn't coming. Like, it's coming later and later, and it's not lasting as long. And when it does, and it's shifting, right? Like, it didn't really... I mean, we had a cold period in December. We had a couple of cold days, but it didn't really, really get cold until, like, January. I remember wearing a heavy coat on Halloween, and I was already growing up in a warming world, so my memories are already of a world that had warmed. And so I think if you're old enough and you have a little bit of memory, you're sort of seeing it in those shifts. I think the problem comes when you're transient and you maybe don't have the historical memory. So when I went to grad school, I moved on the first day of September and it was hot. I knew it was hot, but I didn't think anything of it. And my roommate kept complaining it was very hot. And I was just like, eh, you're soft. And then I realized it was actually the first time Boston had had a heat wave in September. So she wasn't soft. It was unusual. I just didn't have that historical memory to recognize it. And so I often tell people, like, you know, we are very lucky. We live in a country with amazing public science. There's all of this public information. Go on NOAA's website and look up what the historical weather has been in your area. You can see it. You can sort of get a sense of how much things have changed.
How much are you or your team at the Times tracking the sort of business or economic opportunities that may be identified by the changing temperatures and the climate? I think, you know, we were talking this morning about the way the climate's changing for farming and crops and what the response is for that.
I think we're starting to do that. One of the things that's been really hard is we've been around, I think, as a desk for about 3 years. And also, reporting on climate change is unique in that it literally touches every aspect of our life. So it's this really massive topic, and we're still learning and growing on the best ways and the ways that it shifts to cover it. So we've done a little bit of that, but I think we're still moving in that direction, and we're still learning.
How many papers today have a desk devoted to covering this issue?
That's a really good question. So I don't know.
Who are your competitors?
I'm not telling. No. I know the Washington Post does climate reporting. Inside Climate News is all climate reporting. A lot of people have environment desks, which are not necessarily climate specific, but they do a lot of climate change. I know the Times Picayune does. The LA Times does some pretty good climate reporting. Those are the ones off the top of my head, but it kind of it comes from all over, really.
If somebody was wanted to learn more about this issue, where would you tell them to go, other than your website?
The New York Times, nytimes.com/climate. Oh, that's a really good question. I was going to say Twitter, but don't do that. It really depends on who you follow. oh, God. I don't know if I know.
Is there a science blog? Is there a magazine that is really devoted itself and leading the way on this kind of reporting and coverage?
Yeah, I don't mean to punt, and it's not because I don't want to, like, name something. I think I'm just really bad at this because, like, I spend my days reading, like, Nature and Science, so it's, like, really hard for me to be like, oh, you should read. These guys are great. But that is a good question and one I should probably be prepared to answer in the future.
All right.
Although, you know, actually, the government, actually, NOAA and NASA both have a lot of really great explainers aimed for kids. And if you go on YouTube, they actually have, and you Google NOAA, like, climate change or NASA climate change, they actually have some pretty fun videos. So, like, that's pretty much going to the source. But they actually have a lot of stuff that NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or maybe it's oceanographic. I always get that word wrong. But they have a lot of really good material that's aimed at a general audience.
Have you reported, or has anybody on your team reported, what our approach nationally is to teaching this issue in the schools?
I think Idaho had a, was it Idaho that had? Yeah, so we reported on that actually.
I didn't know I was setting that up. Plead ignorance.
That was Livia reported on that. I don't think that there is a national standard. I know on teaching climate change.
Are there states that are doing or cities that are doing it well?
That I don't know.
Okay. What are another question from the audience? So thank you. What are the biggest contributors right now to greenhouse gas, whether it's an industry or whether it's an industry within a country? And what is the challenge with that?
I'm so bad because I can't remember the little map that the EPA has. But like transportation is huge. Heating and cooling. And then like I think agriculture is like fifth or third or fourth on somewhere. It's definitely smaller than transportation, heating, and housing. It's 8% of the United States, if my memory is correct, but it works out to be like a dramatic amount because we have so many emissions in the U.S. So it ends up being like as much as like Ireland emits overall or something. But transportation and like heating and cooling are like the biggest, or electricity is transportation, electricity, and then like it's some weird category that is essentially heating and cooling are like the top three.
Are there countries that are bad actors and major contributors to the problem?
Yeah. We're number one. No. It depends on how you slice it. So in total emissions, China beats us, but on a per capita basis, we beat China. Yeah.
Is China taking steps to address that problem? Are they more proactive, perhaps, than we are?
They have been more proactive than we have. They've passed like rules around electrifying cars. It's tricky with China because they're also growing really less quickly than they have in the past. And then there's another element that, sorry, I'm getting really wonky now, but people think about when they're trying to attribute emissions, which is that a lot of China's emissions are generated creating products for other countries. And so there's always a question of how much of that should go to China and how much should that go to the countries that are actually consuming the product. But the flip side of that is we can't control the production methods in China. So should we be blamed for something that they for the method that they choose to produce something? On the other hand, a lot of our solar panels are made in China now. In fact, like you were talking about the economy piece, one of the big things in the economy piece that people have talked about for a while is that as we move towards renewable energy, the installation jobs you can't outsource, right? Like somebody in, I don't know, New York can't install a wind farm in Idaho, right? It's a little difficult. But the materials themselves are being imported. So like Europe leads the way with the actual, like France and like Denmark, I want to say, are the biggest with wind turbines. And then a lot of the solar panels are produced in China because we sort of missed that boat.
We're probably have time for just a couple more questions, so I'll try to do a flash around here of a few. I was listening to an NPR Fresh Air interview about a month ago, and it was with an author who had written a book about the declining belief in science in our country. As frustrating as that may sound, do you see that yourself? And then secondly, how do you deal and manage with that in the way that you do your job?
So I don't know if I can say I see that because I don't know what the baseline belief was. I do know that there are a lot of flat earthers on Twitter. I forgot about this. At PopSci, one of their top performing stories for a really long time was 10 ways you can tell for yourself that the earth is round. The tips are great. I mean, like if you have kids, they're actually like great just from a like scientific exploration perspective, but it is kind of hilarious that you have to convince people of that. So I guess in some sense I have seen that. I don't really think about that at all. I just sort of focus on telling the story and supplying the evidence that people know, and people are going to reject or accept it regardless. It's not my job to convince them. It's my job to present the facts.
Okay. How responsive do we need to be now to slow the train down? I mean, do we have another 10 years and another two presidential election cycles to figure this out? Or
no. No.
That's too quick an answer.
Sorry. It's not just that we're not slowing the train down. It's that this train is actually accelerating. So every day that we don't actually take steps to reduce emissions, that's that much more effort that we're going to have to put at the end to slow that train down, right? And so that means that the things that you're unwilling to give up today are things that you wouldn't have to give up if we did it at a more moderated pace. You may have to give up at the end because we so drastically need to get rid of carbon emissions.
And I guess I will wrap up with this question, kind of bringing it back full circle. Is your job reporting on doom and gloom?
So it started off as a joke because my coworker did a lot of earthquake reporting and I did a lot of like climate change and like hurricane stuff. So she was doom and I was gloom, and it and it just sort of stuck, and it kind of perpetuated because people often ask me like, how do I have hope and how do I like all of these things? But I don't feel like it's my job to have hope. I do think. I think a lot of the things that I look at are pretty grim, and I think hope is a very American emotion, like the idea that you have to have hope to do things. And I think a lot about how, like, I don't know, they're like, if I don't know, this is really bad, but like, I hate using this example because it's Godwin's law, but like, if you knew the Nazis were going to win, would you join them? Like, at some point, you just sort of have to accept that some battles are worth fighting regardless of the outcome.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for talking about the job that you do and the wonderful things that you get to report on. Thanks to our audience today and great questions. Sorry that I didn't get to all of them. Kendra, what are you doing the rest of your time here in Boise?
I think I have like a dinner set up. I'm like, I don't know. And then I think I'm going to try and sneak away and do a little bit of work, actually.
Okay, great. Well, again, thanks for coming this afternoon, and we look forward to seeing you at the next forum.
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise in a forum titled, Is Gloom My Beat? Reporting on a Changing Planet with New York Times climate reporter Kendra Pierre-Lewis. And the City Club of Boise is a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club forum is the second annual Marilyn Schuller Forum on Human Rights, honoring Idaho Senator Sheree Buckner Webb, which will take place on Tuesday, the 23rd of April at the Grove Hotel in downtown Boise. You can find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member of the City Club of Boise, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org or by calling 208-371-2221. You can also connect on Facebook and on Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.